From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
I think the state's credit rating, which has already been downgraded a couple times in the last year, would be downgraded again, potentially.
Look, Dan Malloy is not going to be any type of lame duck.
We could have easily said, well, if it passes and the governor vetoes it, then we'll just run another budget. And if it passes and the governor vetoes it, run another budget. That is not a way to lead the state.
We hope to really improve the region, the north central region, with this casino.
You're not going to turn Connecticut around on a dime, but you can't objectively look at Connecticut and not appreciate that we are making progress.
This country was built on immigrants. This is America. I think this is who we are, and he's trying to make it look like something different that we're not.
If you're an immigrant who attacks Americans, then we talk about policy change. If you're born here in the United States, it doesn't seem that we're allowed to talk about how we make our country safer.
It's been stated over and over again that they need a political win. You know who needs a win? The American people need a win.
You can join the conversation, not just about the week's news, but about the year's news today on The Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're going to take a look at some of the big stories of the year and try to get a sense from our panelists about what things they'll really remember about this kind of crazy 2017. We would love to hear your voice in here as well. As always, we're joined by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello, Colin.
I'm concerned that Danny still doesn't understand the concept of the show.
We're going to find out from Dan Haar. He's associate editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Danny.
Good morning. I understand the concept, but not the constraints.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to talk about the constraints in just a moment. Suzanne Bates is here, policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello, Suzanne.
Good morning.
So I'll start with you, Colin. And before we get into some specifics, because you all shared with me some stories from this year that you want to talk about a bit more specifically, and maybe we'll get into some of this week's news as well. Colin, give me a little takeaway from this year. I mean, is there one big thing out of this year of so many things happening that you're going to take away from 2017?
Well, you used the word remember in your introduction. And I guess one of the questions that I have is, will people remember anything? I've become interested. I've been spending some time looking back at Watergate and asking myself the question, did people know what they were in the middle of? At what point did people know what they were in the middle of, what was happening? And I think sort of consciousness of the unfolding narrative is something that I'm here at the end of 2017 interested in right now too. Do we know what's happening right now? And there's sort of a little extra camel's hump on that thought, which is, I think one part of this, one part of the submerging of consciousness of what's happening has been the retraction of public input at both the state and federal level. Increasingly, we see things, important things happen. The tax bill that's passing right now is just the latest example, but it happened a lot at the state level this year on a lot of different subjects where things are passed without public hearings, sometimes without open debate in the legislative bodies. And one of the ways that we know what's happening is we discuss it. We participate. Certain people participate in it. Their public testimony is taken. I mean, if you think about Watergate, that's one of the ways we ultimately knew what was happening in Watergate. There were hearings, and things got explained in the context of those hearings. So to me, I'm sort of wrestling right now with this whole question of collective memory and maybe whatever the present time version of collective memory is. Do we understand what's happening right now? When we go back and look at 2017, 5 years from now, will we say they just had no idea what was going on?
Let me just ask you quickly, Colin, does this remind you specifically of Watergate? I mean, is there something about what was happening at that time during those hearings that you directly are hearkening back to as you see the news or the lack of news on some things today, or does it feel different to you?
I've been listening to, and I will recommend to people, a podcast which has been launched, I think, under the Slate brand, and it's called Slow Burn. It's hosted by a young journalist, and it is a series of miniature reported essays about Watergate. And it's really interesting. And I feel like I lived through Watergate as a young adult, sort of college student, kind of young adult. And so that I have some clear memory of it, and I've spent some time reading about it. But it turns out I don't. There's a whole bunch of things that that I'd forgotten. But one of the things that came up this week, and maybe this answers your question, is He interviewed Leslie Stahl a bit. She and Bob Woodward were among the first people reporting it. And I guess I never knew this, but they started dating for a while they were reporting it. But anyway, she talked about a moment where Walter Cronkite, because, in fact, this story had not really gotten traction with the public, where Walter Cronkite decided he would take a crack at it. And I think for two nights, dedicating like 14 minutes of his evening news, which is a lot in network news, and breaking format a little bit so that there were like flow charts and visual aids and stuff, tried to explain to the American public what Watergate was and why it reached further, why it wasn't a third-rate burglary, why it was so much more than that, and got nowhere. So in a way, I think that's one of the things that when that was being described on the podcast, I thought, well, there's sort of that right now. Whether you're talking about the Mueller investigation or something else, there's a way in which things don't penetrate. And I know the point that you're going to make a little bit later, and I think those two points are connected, but we'll wait and get to that.
Well, maybe I can turn to Suzanne. So for you, I mean, what's a big takeaway from this year?
So I think that I'm going to try and squeeze a few in here just because, I'm sorry, it's really hard to do one. But the hashtag MeToo moment, you know, that where women have really started talking about some of the issues that they've been dealing with for years, sexual harassment, especially, you know, in the workplace, in their personal lives. I think the conversation we're having is good and productive right now about some of those issues that, you know, and things are coming to light that are really uncomfortable for a lot of people. And in the halls of power, you know, whether it's business or media or you know, the government. And so I think that's good, right? We need to have these conversations. These things need to stop. So that's definitely one. I think another is this idea that we're kind of getting more tribal in the United States. I worry about that a lot. I don't know if you've seen the Pew does this, you know, sort of attitudinal survey every year. And it used to be that we kind of both the left and the right kind of hovered around the middle. And the gap between the left and the right is growing. And I think what that does is it makes you afraid to be outside of your group. Right. So it used to be that you could be a Republican who believed in, you know, low taxes, but maybe didn't feel as strongly about immigration. But now if you're outside your group, you feel a little bit alone, you know, and you get pushed out of the group if you don't kind of toe the line on everything. And I think that's happening on the left, too. So I feel concerned about that because I think people are more nuanced and we should be allowed to be more nuanced in our opinions about things. And then the third thing I would say is regarding the state of Connecticut, the word for me this year has been debt. The Office of Fiscal Analysis did this great presentation at the beginning of the year about fixed costs. And, you know, Connecticut is just drowning in debt, whether it's pension liabilities or, you know, hard debt in terms of our bonded debt. And it's just dragging the whole state down. So there are my three.
We'll talk about debt coming up at the state of Connecticut in just a moment. As a fiscal conservative, I can say you overspent your allotment of one thing, but I will give you a pass here for a moment. And Danny now is probably going to go to like 20 things, but
I'm going to narrow it down. I'm going to say
Danny.
Just one thing.
Okay, one thing.
And
here we go.
Because my two friends on the left and the right here, in reverse order of ideology, have given mostly narrative descriptions of their take on the year. I'm going to go with a number.
Okay.
And that number is $1.45 billion. $1.45 billion is the collapse of the state income tax from expectations 2 years ago to the actual most likely reality now for the current fiscal year. And so now the collapse of the income tax is not terribly interesting as a narrative item in and of itself, but it tells you a lot about what's happening with Connecticut, both in the state and out of the state. And it also gets us to the federal tax reform, which is an attack on the income tax as well. And most of the problems that accrue to the state of Connecticut fiscally, and I would argue in terms of leadership, can be essentially boiled down to the issue that the income tax is collapsing. Now, that may be because people don't like it here and they're leaving. It may be because we're not taxing billionaires enough. It may be because we don't, for any number of reasons, companies aren't doing as well, hiring. But all of these things are linked. And that's why that $1.45 billion collapse, by the way, which is about 14 or 15%. So in other words, in the space of 2 years, the main tax that we rely on to run the state collapsed by about 15% in just the 2-year cycle.
All right. So let's table that for a second, because I think that's the thing. One of the things that we're going to be talking about in just a moment. I just want to pick up on the second of Suzanne's 3 points, which is really my big takeaway from the year. And it's this idea of overload. We've been talking about something like this for years. You know, we've bemoaned a 24-hour news cycle that's been happening ever since really 9/11. But this is the first year I felt like it was a real thing. Like, literally, I had to wake up every morning and I had to watch what the president of the United States had tweeted overnight and how that might affect something in my life, how it might affect not just the stock markets, but actually the way government works. It might prompt at least talk about some sort of a conflict with North Korea. Then what happens after this 24-hour news cycle is we get the blame and we get the fighting on every little small point. And I think to your point, Suzanne, that I was thinking about that Pew chart as well. Whenever we are scared, and this is a back of the brainstem kind of thing that has nothing to do with us being advanced humans in 2017. This is like really basic animal stuff. If we get scared and unhappy, we retreat to a safe place. And our safe place is either red or blue. And then, I don't know, Colin, I think that that's what happens is we then reinforce these stereotypes based on these safe places. And 2016-17 is the first year really smart people in politics and, I suppose, in Russia, people who write algorithms and bots have figured this out and have actually exacerbated this problem. So now we wake up angrier and more overloaded. And I, honest to God, think that a year like this takes years off of our lives. And I don't love that.
So I just want to respond quickly to one thing you said at the end there, because I think it's a really important thing. I mean, and a lot of the reporting and even intelligence on the Russian front, as it were, it indicates that although Putin had a preference for who would win the 2016 election, his real preference is for exactly the phenomenon that you're describing. For he wants our system of government not to work. He wants our society to function suboptimally. And so to the extent that you and Suzanne are correct, he would be very happy about that. I do want to say that I don't disagree with anything that either you or Suzanne said about this, but I do feel like there's kind of a way in which it kind of reflects back on itself. And here's what I mean, that yes, absolutely tribalism has become more ferocious, but intertribal squabbling has become tribal squabbling has become rather ferocious too, and maybe in a way that's ultimately healthy. So the Democrats are having, you know, I mean, to make it as simplistic as possible, there's a Bernie vision, there's a Clinton vision, right? And they still haven't settled that argument. They don't know what kind of party they're going to run as in 2018 or 2020. The Republican Party has, I think, another problem, which is obviously they're being led into battle by a guy that a lot of them are really uncomfortable with. So what do they do about that? In some ways, they can take advantage of some of the momentum that he creates and maybe some of the chaos that he creates to get some of the things that they want, which might actually be somewhat different from things that he at least nominally wanted during his campaign. But ultimately, they have some soul searching. I think each side, it's not a safe space. You run back to that side, and there's a fight going on inside the walls of your little village.
So I agree with that to a point, Suzanne, but I will say I think part of when you retreat to your safe little corner and you're there and you're only listening to your own little echo chamber on the right or on the left, I think that really is where the squabbles start. I mean, if you're locked in a room with your family, I mean, at a certain point, you're going to start yelling at each other. Well, what do you see on the Republican side of this? We have this Bernie-Hillary factional battle that's pretty clear on the Democratic side. What does it look like on the Republican side right now?
Steve Bannon versus sort of, you know, the Mitt Romney, you know, that kind of wing of the party. That's Steve Bannon is really sort of leading that Trump charge outside of the Trump administration now. And it's interesting because he was trying to find someone to run against Mitt Romney in Utah because there are rumors that Mitt Romney is going to run for Orrin Hatch's seat. And you're seeing this sort of, you know, definitely an inter-party squabble. Not just squabble. It's a battle royale. You know, I mean, it's going to the never Trumpers versus the pro Trumpers on the right. It's ripping the Republican Party apart, you know, but you're seeing that sort of happening on the left, too. And I think when you're fighting amongst yourselves, but then it's one thing, but then you're really afraid. Again, I think there's this fear of being kicked out of your group at some point when you get so polarized like this. So people will retreat to some of these ideas that they might be uncomfortable with because they don't want to get kicked out of their group.
Yeah, an interesting one recently that goes along those lines has been a battle within the Democratic Party over how should we treat Al Franken. Right? Should we ostracize Al Franken? Should we welcome Al Franken in and say that actually what Donald Trump did is much worse? And there's a real battle that I'm watching going on in social media amongst a bunch of people. Do you have a thought on this, Dave?
I don't buy this whole tribalism nonsense. This is ridiculous. We've had tribalism in the 1980 election. The Democrats were divided between the Kennedy and Carter forces of populism versus corporatism, and so were the Republicans between Reagan and. Who was the candidate? I forgot.
Mondale?
No. On the Republican side. There's always, in every election cycle, I'll think of that in a second, there's been division.
Well, Bush ran against Reagan.
Bush ran against Reagan, of course.
Voodoo economics.
Right. How could I forget Bush? In every election cycle, both parties are divided between populism and corporatism. This isn't new. This is something different. What's new is that we elected because of a swing of 70,000 angry white male 50-something ex industrial workers in the Midwest. We elected a guy who duped his public because he thinks they think he's going to help them when he's not. And this is a person who doesn't care about ideas. This is the stress here. This is a person who doesn't care about truth, doesn't care about ideas at all, and is an anti-intellectual. That's the problem. It's not tribalism.
Let me just push back a little bit on the tribalism piece, though, Danny. I've been thinking about this a lot. Trump staged a press conference the other day in which he had big stacks of paper and then small stacks of paper. And the point was he's trying to get rid of all the regulations. And there's all these regulations now, and there's fewer regulations back in 1960. It's like, well, the world was a much less complex place in 1960.
Yes.
The economy was much smaller. There was a lot less paperwork to do. Much like that, when you talk about corporatism versus populism, the qualities and the complexities of corporatism, for instance, today versus 1980, I would say are pretty different. I mean, that's a different type of tribal battle, I think. I think that there's a lot more at stake, and there's a lot more differentiation between the groups, don't you?
There are qualitative differences, but the operative issue that's going on right now is not the fractured party politics or the personal what Suzanne is talking about, people in their various tribes and fitting in. We've always had that. I had that in the 70s in high school when we were talking about who we were. The problem is that we elected a guy who doesn't care about truth or ideas. That's the stress.
I just want to – this is my Christmas or holiday gift to Suzanne. I was listening to the way that you were describing the division in the Republican Party, and it made me think of a paradigm that's been set up by a journalist I've known for a long time, Dahlia Lithwick, who says that everybody's either an order Muppet or a chaos Muppet. This is why it's my gift to you, because you've got all those kids and stuff. So you can, and I think, so basically, the Cookie Monster, Animal, Gonzo, these are chaos Muppets, and obviously Kermit, is – and Sam the Eagle and people like that. Those are order Muppets. And all of us, Danny's more of a chaos Muppet. Suzanne's more of an order Muppet. And I think the Republican Party really has a problem. It really is in some ways chaos. I mean, Bannon and Trump are chaos Muppets. They don't want the restoration of order. You hear John McCain talking about regular order. Well, there's a lot of people who do not want the restoration of order. They want chaos. And I think, in a way, the divisions in the party are a little bit different. I think the Democratic Party has a stark ideological division right now. Are they Clinton centrists or are they a Bernie populist? I think for the Republican Party, what they're struggling with right now is how do you do business? Mitch McConnell is an order Muppet, right? But the order Muppets have lost control. I mean, they are trying to function within a very chaotic environment.
Wouldn't you say, though, there's a little bit of that on the left, too? I don't know. I'm watching sort of some of the, There are chaos Muppets on the left, and
Bernie's a chaos Muppet to a certain degree. I mean,
like
basically,
the Occupy one of those old Wall guys Street in the box. Crowd, right? Like your Occupy Wall Street crowd, your Black Lives Matter crowd. They want to destabilize the prevailing order, sort of, and Bernie has sort of been their, kind of leader, right? In that, but they want to destabilize the order because they feel like it's not working for certain populations, so I think there's probably desires for that chaos on each side, and then. Your more centrist order-seeking people, I think, are losing on both sides of the aisle right now.
I'll just push back real quick, Suzanne, and say I think that when you say the Black Lives Matter crowd, that's a crowd of people who would like to see less racism against black people. That's not necessarily a political movement as much as a group of people who'd like to see less racism against black people.
I think that's true to a degree, but a lot of the white people that worked in the Occupy Wall Street movement actually moved over to the Black Lives Movement when they there's some overlap there. Of course, I think the broad population of sort of like grassroots people in the Black Lives Matter movement feel that way for sure. But I think, you know, of course, it's political as well.
We've all become chaos Muppets now. We've gone past our break, and there's a lot more to talk about. We'll get to some specifics on what was big and small about the news on the state level and the national level throughout 2017. And Liz, we look ahead to 2018 with Suzanne Bates, Policy Director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, and WNPR's Colin McEnroe in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, and we're talking about the week's news with Suzanne Bates, Policy Director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Dan Haar, Associate Director and Columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what's on your show today?
I can barely even describe what's on our show today, which is not that unusual, really. But we are doing a show about sort of a wrinkle in Darwinian theory. So basically, when you think about how we think about sexual selection, mate selection in Darwinian theory, the idea is that the male acquires all these attributes and then is able to kind of dominate the field and get females. Whereas there are some relatively new thinking about this that it doesn't work that way. The females are much more in the driver's seat than one might suppose.
Chaos.
It doesn't work that way just in humans or across the board?
No, across the board. Birds. We're also going to be talking about duck sex because you have to talk about duck sex and duck penises and stuff like
that. Happy holidays.
It's not a pleasant subject.
Is Greg Morago on the show?
You'll never look at ducks the same way again.
So that's what we call a promo for the Colin McEnroe Show, 1 o'clock today. We'll see who sticks around. It should be interesting. Let's get to a lot of the big stories of 2018. I think a lot of us want to talk about, Dan, you know, what happened with the state budget this year? There's so many parts to that, but essentially we had this long budget battle. As you mentioned before, there's been this collapse in the income tax. We've got a newly constituted state legislature, which was at the heart of some of this. We've got a lame duck governor who's not very popular, who's at the heart of this. What are the big takeaways from you, what happened at the state's capital, especially around the budget?
Well, to combine what I said with what Suzanne said, you've got the she used the word debt. I call it liabilities. Debt implies that we borrowed the money, but it's all the same thing. It's money that we have to pay. And, you know, it's just semantics.
A lot of those liabilities is debt.
Well, that's right. It's $2 billion a year of borrowing over 40 years. That adds up here and there. no question. But in any case, the payments that we have to make for pension, health, retiree benefits combined with Medicaid equal 53% of the budget right now. And that's up from 36% of the budget just 10 years ago, right? So that's a huge chunk of the budget. There's that 15 percentage point difference again, right? And then so you have that 15 percentage points and you have the income tax, which is the major tax, collapsing by 15 percentage points. And you have those costs rising by 4 to 5% a year, those fixed costs. So I hate that word fixed costs because things change. But those liability costs rising by 4 to 5% a year, and you have tax collection rising, in some cases flat completely. This past year was flat, but rising by basically 1 to 2% a year. It's a formula that doesn't work. And if you want to say let's cut, then what did the Republicans do when they cut one thing, which was a Medicaid payment to over 65 people who were poor so that they could make up things that weren't covered by Medicare? So it's Medicaid and Medicare. $54 million in a $2 billion budget, and they couldn't, $20 billion budget, and they couldn't do it. They're going into special session to restore one thing that the governor cut when they said, you cut $800 million worth of stuff. And he said, okay, here's $54 million. That's a little piece. It's about 1% of what he had to cut. Right? And he can't do it. So it's a wonder we have a budget at all, and we don't.
Suzanne, would you like to follow up?
So many places to go on that.
So, okay, go ahead.
So I think what Dan's talking about with our liabilities, I mean, we have our bonded debt, right, which is hard debt, and then we have our liabilities, our pension liabilities, soft debt. But either way you look at it, debt. And I think with our pension liabilities, I think you're seeing its effects everywhere in our daily lives now. How much money is getting to the classroom anymore is affected by, you know, teacher pension liabilities. Our universities and colleges, the professor's ability to apply for federal grants is being affected by pension liabilities because they're so high they're not competitive with other states. You know, we're cutting the state budget services across the board because of pension liabilities. I mean, it really is affecting us on every single level in the state right now. And you know, it's a very difficult thing to wrap your arms around. And so people don't talk about it as much as they ought to. But that's the crisis that Connecticut's facing.
Well, people may not talk about it as much as maybe they could, but I don't know, Colin, we've seen a raft of these articles that have been written by national publications basically saying, hey, what's wrong with Connecticut, man? And they're saying exactly what Suzanne just said in
right.
many cases.
So Governing, Slate, and The Atlantic all wrote within a short period of time basically the same article, which is Connecticut's such a rich state, or at least it used to be such a rich state. These are people from the outside looking in at us. How come they don't have any money? How come they can't fix anything? How come they have all this debt problem? And I'm we talked about these articles in the past, and I don't, you know, not everything in those articles really corresponds perfectly to the lived reality, but close enough. And I don't have any magical answers to this. The one thing that I will say is that nobody has any, not even magical answers, but any real answers. One thing I said as we were emailing around is, I'll do another cultural bridge here. You know, like in one of the conversations they have a lot on The Walking Dead, particularly these days, The Walking Dead is about the zombie apocalypse, is, you know, are they just trying to survive and kill off their worst enemies, or do they want to work towards something more, a permanently livable world that's actually desirable at some level?
The first thing.
Yeah, the first thing.
Are you
that's
talking
basically
about Republicans in the House?
No. I'm just talking about like how leadership is understood in the state of Connecticut. I couldn't tell you the name of a person from either party who has the latter thing, the thing that we're working towards. This is what we want to have. This is what we want Connecticut to be. Here's how we're going to get here. I mean, I could point to little fragments of that. You know, Malloy had certain ideas from the very beginning. But by and large, the legislature has simply worked to survive the zombie apocalypse, right? There isn't really a lot of definitive policy-based leadership in the legislature. It's just like, how are we going to solve these problems so we don't get sucked even deeper into this hole that we're already in? And I think if you look at the gubernatorial field, too, there are not a lot of people, or maybe not any people, you know, with some sort of vision, like, here's where we're standing right now, here's where we need to get, you know, here's how we're going to get there. You don't hear a lot of that. Maybe it's because the problems are so vast and intractable, but I think there's also a vision deficit.
Just quickly, I think there is a clear vision, and that's build up our cities and build up our transportation so that we're a great functioning state. The problem is that all takes a lot of money, and so everything is subsumed by the fact that both the income side and the spending side are overwrought.
Yeah, you have to get at the pension liabilities. You have to figure out how to reduce those and our debt. I mean, our debt service, we're paying 14% of our budget a year on debt service payments. New York's paying 7%. Right. I mean, it's our bonded debt, too. We borrow a lot of money. But to build up our transportation infrastructure, we have to borrow more money. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and they're talking about a 14-cent per gallon tax increase and tolls to try to build up our transportation infrastructure.
Well, and as we look ahead to 2018, I mean, I've heard from a number of people that it seems fairly obvious, Danny, that tolls are going to be on the horizon in some cases. Whenever I've raised the issue of tolls, I almost immediately get back something that sounds like this. Well, tolls aren't going to take care of the whole problem. And I'm like, well, no, nothing's probably going to take care of the whole problem, but it might take care of some of the problem.
You have to take free money where it exists. And in 1991, Lowell Weicker made the point that the income tax was a 30% discount.
when you said that, I couldn't wait to look at Suzanne.
Money.
Yeah, it's free money.
What does that mean?
In 1991, the income tax, which then was, you know, $2 billion or $3 billion or $4 billion, was a 30% discount because it was deductible, fully deductible, and that now has ended, right? So that no longer is that 30%, which until I think this morning, is the signing ceremony going? Are we missing it? Is free money. And now tolls are free money because what are they, 40% from out of state, 60% from out of state? It's 40, 60. I forget which one it is. But it's money from people traveling through the state.
I think it's 40% out of state.
40% out of state. That's what I thought. Right. So we all travel to Boston, to Mass Pike, and we pay $14 to travel back eastbound on the George Washington Bridge. Just or 15 now. It's money that we pay as out of state people to those jurisdictions. And there's no reason why we shouldn't collect it from people out of state. We're getting free money. I'm going to hear it. And okay, go ahead.
It's not free money. I mean, look, you put tolls on every road, and you're asking state residents to pay more, right, for things. And I think the frustration level is from a lot of people. You're asking us to keep paying more on all these different fronts, and the money's just going into this black hole, right? I mean, it feels like the money's going nowhere. And I think, let me just go back really quickly to the pension issue, because I think the problem is we know what a lot of the solutions are, but they're incredibly politically difficult to do.
And maybe legally difficult. That's the other thing. This is not just politically difficult. It's literally legally difficult to do.
The legal issues haven't even been touched here in Connecticut. The other states have been litigating. I mean, California, they're having all kinds of, you know, They're deciding these issues. Here, we're not even trying. And I think that shows a level. I mean, it's the emotional versus the logical, which is a problem, I think, in politics in general.
I wanted to move quickly, Colin, because we've got so much to talk about. You mentioned the whole idea
of like this really cool crossing guard thing.
Yeah.
Like you actually held up traffic with your hands.
I'm working on a whole new series of hand signals for 2018. I'm wondering if we can just talk about the leadership piece of this. I mean, we hear our old buddy Oz Griebel now says he's running as an independent candidate. We've heard and we've talked for weeks about the sort of thin fields on both the Democratic and Republican side. I mean, talk about the leadership thing that we did or didn't see in 2017 and what we might look ahead to here.
Right. Yeah. Well, as we were saying during the break, a lot of order Muppets and not too many chaos Muppets. Maybe that's a good thing. Just to get to Oz for a second, one interesting thing that Oz is doing, and I didn't realize this till this morning, is he's not participating in the citizens' election program, right? He's not getting public financing. He's going to just raise money from people.
Could he if he wanted to?
Well, that's another question. I mean, why? Because you don't think he could qualify?
It's hard to raise that much money.
It's very hard. Yeah. No, if that's what you mean, yes, absolutely. It is very difficult. And, you know, I mean, Oz is a smart guy. Maybe he'll have some ideas. I don't know what they are yet. I mean, we've seen the ideas that have been out there, for the most part, are unworkable ideas. There are a number of Republican candidates, for example, who have proposed repealing the state income tax. I mean, I don't know. When people do that, when people sort of make that a linchpin of their program, I sort of dismiss them as serious candidates. I mean, they don't really have any. I mean, we have enough trouble basically paying for services, dealing with the problems we're having right now with the state income tax. I can't imagine what sort of world – talk about a chaos Muppet. I can't imagine what sort of world they're envisioning. But yeah, I think there's a leadership gap. And part of it, of course, is because the problems are intractable. The kind of people who are good problem solvers, parentheses, Kevin Limbo, close parentheses, don't want this because no matter how smart they are or how good they are at detecting problems and finding solutions, they don't imagine that they could do it this time.
Mm. I think if you can take a personality type that's emerging as the right one, it is both on the Democrat and the Republican side, the candidates who are less ideological and more technocratic that are saying, people are saying, look, we need to solve problems by spending money wisely. We can't have knee-jerk comments on either side about, you know, raising taxes or cutting spending. And that would be, I think Oz Griebel would fit into that. Steve Opsitnik on the Republican side, a number of other people. That are that sort of centrist, technocratic, and one of those will emerge. The difficulty is it's hard to get traction because of the these problems we've been talking about.
Oh, Opsitnik mania is just really starting up these days. I don't know if you.
What's your thought, Suzanne, about the leadership piece of this?
Well, I think it's interesting too that Oz picked a Democrat as a running mate, so he's got a bipartisan ticket happening. So I think that's an interesting angle. I think there are people like Kevin Limbo who did sort of want to back out and on the Republican side too, when they look at some of the problems and the union deal that was signed this past summer, the CBAC deal, really tied the hands of the next governor in a lot of ways. 2019 is going to be a big mess. The budget session, I mean, we think 2017 was a big mess. 2019 is going to be a disastrous mess. So I think, you know, there are people who are backing out because they don't want to deal with that.
Yeah. I would say one reason that Oz has a Democratic running mate, I'm going to now read Oz's mind, but I think his candidacy is a rejection of the two-party system in Connecticut. He was very unhappy with his own position within the Republican Party and how he was treated and the way the Republican Party ultimately wound up seeking, you know, Foley-type candidates as opposed to, as he sees it anyway, somebody like him who has a little bit more hands-on experience with at least public life. And I think that his candidacy is a repudiation of both parties. And I think that's also why he didn't seek a nomination within either one of them.
I don't know about a person, but the group that stands for this is the newly formed Commission on Fiscal Sustainability and Economic Growth, which is chaired. I know you laughed. Oh, it's a commission, right?
No, I know. It's
Jim Smith from Webster Bank and Bob Patricelli, who just retired from Women's Health USA. And they're both about to or just retired. And they're running this bipartisan group of mostly business executives, the chiefs of Stanley and the Hartford and Cindy Bigelow from Bigelow Tea. And this is they as a group, I would say they have a philosophy that says we can't stop investing. We have to get our arms around spending, but we just can't stop. They kept using the word growth, right?
Is Smith going to run for governor?
Apparently not. I think he's doing this commission instead.
Yeah. Continue.
No, that's it. I didn't ask him if he's running for governor, though. I don't think he didn't sound like he was running for governor. And so this is again, it's emerging not as a person but as an idea that this is what we need to move forward, and it's not easy at all.
I want to get to a quick phone call. Doug's calling from Weathershed. Hey, Doug.
Hey, can Suzanne comment more explicitly on what can actually be done about the pension liabilities? It feels like there's a lot of dancing around it, and I know it's an explosive issue, but just teach us.
Well, I thank you very much. So okay, Suzanne, so what can specifically be done? Thank you, Doug, for your
thank
call.
Thank you, Doug. No.
Thanks, Doug.
We have to do more to change what we're doing for new hires on both the teacher pension and state employee side. I know Malloy feels like he's done some work there. Not enough. You've got to make it less expensive and less risky for future taxpayers. And then you're going to have to get at COLAs. I really think that's the key, is you're going to have to get at COLAs, cost of living adjustments, which really aren't cost of living adjustments because they're almost more than what cost of living is actually going up.
And you're talking about
up.
Cost of living adjustments for long-term state employees we're not talking about new hires here. That's a whole different thing. And again, that's a much smaller piece of the overall pie.
Yeah.
You're talking about getting a cost of living adjustments for the big chunk of folks. So how do you do that? I mean, we talked about the legal piece of this. I mean, these are contracts signed, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, how do you do that? Well, the Republicans had the idea this year of changing for post-2027, right? Once the contract is up, this is what we're going to do. And that's what you would have to do is set, this is what we're going to do to COLAs. We're going to zero them out. And this is what they did in Rhode Island. They zeroed them out until they achieved a certain level of funding into the pension plan. They ended up having to compromise on that. But it made a huge difference in their liabilities.
But I guess I just, getting back to Colin's Walking Dead analogy, I guess it's 2027 sort of feels to me like, you know, you're looking at the suburbs of Atlanta being overrun by this point, and I don't know what happens in 2027 if indeed everything blows up before then.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I shouldn't have to fix pension liability. But what I will say is you can't fix it with new hires. I mean, in other words, that's too small a piece of it. And the big problem is the bulk of people who are already under the system. Somewhere down the road, we probably have to talk about employee contribution to the pension plan, but stuff that's under contract right now is very difficult to revisit while the contract obtains. The only other thing that you could possibly do, and I know that I sort of implicitly reject this idea too, you'd almost have to create, and see, this will make Suzanne upset, but you almost have to identify a revenue source, maybe even a new revenue source, and tie it. I mean, really lockbox it, not fake lockbox it, to tier one pensions or something. I mean, there's some way in which this pension thing otherwise is going to suck everything down. It sucks the entire budget process down. Somehow or other, you need to segregate that problem and address it almost separately.
I think all of these conversations really show why governments should not be in the business of pensions, because like the future, the risk is all on this diverse population and the benefit is to this narrow population and it's
but
just
do you see what I'm saying though? There's like a way in which if you don't break it out somehow,
it would show people, do you want it? Because really all the money that they've raised in the last few years and these tax increases has gone to pensions.
Mm-hmm.
So let's show people like this is where your money's going. Is this where you think your tax dollars should go?
If governments are not in the business of pensions, then they're going to have to pay people more money and stop stop paying sanitation engineers in the Department of Health $55,000 who are making $85,000 and $90,000 at the Connecticut Water Companies and Aquarians of the world.
I would
That's the simple fact. I would rather see a pay increase. That's what you're going to find.
Pay in the short term. But I would rather do that than a pension long
term. There's no such thing as free money, unless I'm the one saying there's free money, then there's free money, right?
We'll come back and talk more about free
money.
Could
I just say one thing about that commission that Danny was talking about? Yeah. What's it called again?
Commission on Fiscal Sustainability and Economic Growth.
That for Danny is like the new King Crimson tour for you. Like Danny would just like
that's what
he's buying all their merch.
Robert Fripp is the chairman of this commission.
He's all got like the black T-shirt they sell for $40 on the counter.
We're talking about the news of the week and the year with Colin McEnroe, 21st Century Schizoid Man, Dan Haar from Connecticut Hearst Media, and Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute. When we come back, a few more stories from the year, maybe a little bit of a more of a look ahead in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe from WNPR, Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Coming up next week, we'll be taking a little break here on The Wheelhouse, and we'll hear an episode from WNYC's Supreme Court podcast called More Perfect. It's about a 1962 redistricting case that Chief Justice Earl Warren said was the most important case of his tenure. It's a fantastic podcast. Hope you can join us for this special coming up next week in this slot as we take a little holiday break. Boy, there's so much more to talk about. I don't know. Maybe Suzanne will talk quickly about the thing that the Republicans were trying to do for months now, and that they finally got done just before the end of the year. This big tax overhaul or cut or whatever we want to call it. We've said quite a bit about how it's not necessarily designed for people in states like Connecticut or New York or California. It is designed for people in a lot more red states. What do you see in this bill?
I think it's going to be really interesting. I think it actually so it's been interesting watching progressives talk about this bill because they're freaking out. It's, you know, people are going to die, blah, blah, blah. People are going to see their taxes go down, and especially among the middle class. I think what you're seeing with the SALT deduction, the state and local tax deduction, that's mostly taken by high income earners. You know, the mortgage interest deduction is now capped for big houses, big expensive houses. You know, people are freaking out about this, but I think it's actually going to be a good thing for a lot of middle class Americans. And I think people will be happy. And it's funny because the last time I was here, everyone was like, oh, the Republicans say they're going to do tax reform, you know, but they couldn't get Obamacare repeal done, this, that, the other. The Republicans like their taxes, you know, and they like to do tax reform. And this is a huge overhaul, and I think it's going to be good for the country.
According to the Joint Committee on Taxation, the cuts that accrue to people at or below, I think, 60,000, it may be 50,000, amount to about 3% of the cuts here. So, yeah, sure, there are cuts to the middle class. Absolutely. Is that what we want? Sure. Do that. And move on. This isn't what's happening here. What we have here is an enormous, huge cut for corporations that have $2.5 trillion in cash on their balance sheets in the S&P 500. It is a record number. If it isn't a record, it's a very near record, right? What are you going to do with Pfizer that has $80 billion or whatever? That's not, used to be 80. It's not 80 anymore. What are you going to do with, just to use like Priceline, which is not that big a company here in Connecticut, $6.5 billion on their balance sheet, cash. What are they going to do with more cash? They're not going to spend it investing, because if they were, they would have done it already. The reason is because there isn't demand, because the middle class isn't doing well enough, and not enough of this tax cut accrues to the middle class. And the fact that it expires in 8 to 10 years is just cruelty.
I think when you – if you talk to a middle-class person, any extra cash in their pocket is a good thing. And I do think that the corporate tax cuts are going to help. They're going to make us more competitive globally, right? We're in a global economy. Our taxes in the United States were higher than most other countries.
No, actually, the 20% actual paid corporate tax rate is about the same as
it
is
with the deductions. It was an incredibly complicated tax code that companies had to pay.
This is not any less complicated.
It's equally complicated
with a lower bill.
Suzanne, I'll just before we hear from Colin, I just want to quickly ask you, though, to Danny's point, and it is true that so many of the big corporations that are going to be the beneficiaries of these tax cuts have indeed had the opportunity to invest trillions of dollars into the American economy, and they haven't. The question is, taking aside whether or not this makes us more competitive globally with a raw tax number, how does this actually spark them to make new investments? How do we guarantee that it drives up economic growth here in the country in the way that this tax bill pretends to do?
I don't think you can guarantee anything. But I do think that as you cut expenses, people invest more. And I think we will see more investment in the economy. I know that there are companies that have a lot of cash on the books. I hear people say, you know, we need projects to invest in. So, I mean, it's where do we invest? And I think that's the next question, right? We need to get the economy moving on a variety of levels. We need to get people back to work. The number of people that have dropped out of the market in terms of looking for jobs has been alarming in the U.S.
Colin?
I want to circle back to a few things that were said at the beginning of the show. Suzanne, I think maybe her first word was debt. So debt is a problem here, right? Mm-hmm. This is a tax cut that does not balance, that increases the deficit. The only question is how much does it increase the deficit? One of the things, prejudices that Danny and I share is against tax cuts or budgeting in general. It depends on assumptions about economic growth. That may or may not be supportive, but seem highly speculative. So this could even be more deficit inflaming if, in fact, economic growth doesn't happen the way is being that it is being predicted, and kind of in the part of the conversation you two guys were just having. But I want to go back to another thing that was said at the beginning by me, which is that if Republicans care a lot about taxes, they don't care enough to do it the right way, right? So this is a historic tax bill in terms of size. It's going to be one of the big tax reform bills in the last 100 years. It was done with no public debate and no public input. It was done slapdash, helter-skelter, right down to the last minute, changes being written in pen or magic marker or whatever they write their changes in. And as a result, a lot of things that really need to be considered haven't been considered. I will give you one example. I don't think anybody has any idea at this point what this bill is going to do to charitable donations, to nonprofit donations. If, in fact, you double the standard deduction, I mean, there are think tanks trying to figure that out right now. And in the nonprofit sector, there's quite a bit of panic about this. That's just one example. I mean, there's sort of a lot of bullet effects from changes of this magnitude. It has been done in a sorry fashion, in a way that is meant to exclude sober consideration and public awareness of what's happening. And I think that's the greatest shame of it.
Dan, a quick thought?
So bad that even this morning the House has to vote again because they forgot the fact that the Senate had to cheat on the rules in order to make it a 50-50 vote instead of a 60-40 vote because it affects the budget.
So Suzanne, I think one of the things that we do talk a lot about at the state level is the way the work gets done shows up in the quality of the work, right? When you do it at the last possible moment, just before the 11th hour, just before the session is up, you probably get bad legislation you got to go back and fix. The Republicans, having considered this for some time, seem to have put themselves, I'll say it more gently than Colin did, in that position. So does that cause part of the problem? The American public doesn't seem to like this bill very much right now, and I'm not quite sure how to get past that piece of it.
So, yes, I agree. I think process is important. I think the process wasn't great on this. I also am worried about the increase in the debt. I think that it's probably in better shape than people think. I think it's going to help more people. I think part of it is like some of the media, I mean, the New York Times has been freaking out about this tax reform, like freaking out. And so I think most people think their taxes are going to go up when that's not true. Most people are going to see their taxes go down. Maybe not in Connecticut.
Most New York Times readers are going to see their taxes
yes,
go up.
Right. Which is why I think they're freaking out about it. But most Americans not going to see their taxes go up. And so I think many people are going to be pleasantly surprised. Oh, my taxes actually went down. I'm actually getting more money in my pocket.
The debt part of this is in better shape. I most independent analysis indicates that the deficit part of this is a big problem. And it gets back to, yes, if the IRS can ever figure this out, and they're not being given a lot of time to figure out how any of this crazy stuff works as the tax year begins to unfold on January 1st, that's another thing. There's such a short window between passage of this and then it's unfolding as an actual taxation reality. But anyway, if anybody – I've actually completely lost my train of thought at this point. But if anybody can ever figure this out, my guess is what's going to happen is, like, say you're in the middle income quintile. you might get about $50 a week, something like that, $60 a week, which is good. You can go to Chili's, you know, but the debt is going to go up. So it's like you have an abscess tooth and they give you intravenous Valium. Yeah. You're going to feel good. You're still going to have an abscess tooth.
Yeah, very short thought.
The issue isn't just debt. It's when the debt. Sorry. And right now we're at 4.1% unemployment, not the time to stimulate an economy that is in the eighth year of an expansion, which is precisely when you have the most danger of another recession.
This was fun today, I think. Dan Haar, associate editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Thanks so much, Danny.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Suzanne Bates, policy director of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Thank you, Suzanne.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
And thank you, Mr. Dan Koski.
Hey, happy holidays to everyone listening, and to technical producer Kion Wolf, and to executive producer Katie Talarski. Thanks for joining us all this year long on The Wheelhouse. We'll be back for more in 2018, I promise.